Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Barnett versus Barnett.
May it please the court, Mr. Dwyer and Mr. Dana will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Dwyer will open with the first 5 minutes. Mr. Dana will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Robin Dwyer and I represent the petitioner Ann Dice. I'm going to talk primarily about the summary judgment issues and the situation below as it has to do procedurally with the judgment rendered by the Court of Appeals. Our petition was filed because the Court of Appeals went beyond the pleadings and the summary judgment motions and the law in granting a joint and several judgment against Ann Dice for the entire one half of the Prudential policy proceeds. As stated in the brief, the Court of Appeals can only render such judgment or decree as the court below should have rendered. As such, it could only grant the relief that the plaintiff actually requested, for which the plaintiff met its burden of proving that there were no contested issues of fact, and as a matter of law, they were entitled to judgment. In order to determine that, the Court of Appeals did not do, didn't examine any of the facts or the summary judgment motions. They have to examine the procedural record. The plaintiff's second motion for partial summary judgment, the first amended second motion for partial summary judgment, which is the one the court actually granted, state in their request that they want to determine that the policies of insurance on the life of her deceased husband are community property. It's the one thing they asked for. Second, that their interest in the life insurance policies were not forfeited under ERISA. And third, that she was deprived of her community interest in the life insurance proceeds through constructive fraud. All of these motions were for partial summary judgment, not final summary judgment. The prayers for relief in both motions prayed as to my client and the other donee defendants that each defendant transferee of Dora Ernestine Luck Barnett be declared a constructive trustee for the benefit of plaintiff and to pay to her the sums of money each of them received with pre-judgment and post-judgment interest. Requests for relief are identical in the motions that were granted by the Court of Appeals. Dice did not file a motion for summary judgment. So we're not dealing with the issue of cross motions for summary judgment as to my client, Dice. The court denied the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment by a written order on the grounds that fact issues existed on the issue of civil conspiracy, on the issue of whether constructive trust should be imposed against Dice. Before the Court of Appeals can render a final judgment, both parties must have sought a final summary judgment in their cross motions. It didn't exist in this case. Procedural history below doesn't support that level of case law upon which the respondent relies in the Court of Appeals granting a final summary judgment against the petitioner Dice. The only motion that could have been granted sought only partial relief and only to the extent of actual money received. The summary judgment evidence, which is undisputed, shows that my client received a gift of $10,000. That gift came from Ernestine Luck Barnett, who was the beneficiary under the will of Christopher Barnett. The summary judgment evidence in the case, and all of that summary judgment that there was, showed a check register. The summary judgment evidence showed that there was, in fact, a check written out to my client for $10,000.
Did the Court of Appeals properly render judgment against your client for $10,000?
Could they properly render judgment?
Yes.
No.
Why not?
The reason they can't
what
do it...
What issue remains open as to your client?
The issue of whether or not there's any proof of civil conspiracy, the issue not of whether there's any proof of constructive fraud. The whole theory of constructive fraud on which the plaintiff's case lies says that the spouse cannot defraud the other spouse by giving away community property, by designation of the beneficiary is what they claim in this case, or the cases are replete with many ways in which someone gave away community property.
Is there a challenge before this court to the findings related, or to the decision related to the constructive fraud claim, separate and apart from the joint and several liability issue?
I certainly challenge it on the what we're here for before. I don't think the Court of Appeals could have done it. I don't think the trial court could have done it.
I mean, I understood your challenge to be that because there was no determination that there was a conspiracy, that the rendition of judgment on joint to several grounds was not proper.
Well, there's also a challenge on the issue of there's no right to propose a constructive trust as to my client. The facts are clear that Ernestine Luck Barnett, even under the opinion of the Court of Appeals, had $468,000 worth of cash that was hers to give as she pleased. The plaintiff in a constructive trust has to establish arrest, has to trace it into the hands, and show that they have an equity or interest in it. There's no proof of that. There's no summary judgment proof of that. And there was no evidence introduced at trial.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. I represent Dora Ernestine Luck Barnett. She is the mother of the decedent, Christopher Allen Barnett. And I also represent the seven co-defendants whom the Court of Appeals referred to as the West defendants. This is probate litigation, as the Court well knows, that involves ERISA, community property considerations, probate code provisions, the effect of a directed verdict in a jury trial, joint and several liability. Many issues are presented, and I think they've been fairly adequately briefed by all sides in this case. Given the constraints of my time, I'd like to limit my discussion to ERISA, community property as it relates to this case, and to the issue of attorney's fees. As this Court knows, this case involved an employee who worked for HLNP. He had three life insurance policies. They had total benefits of $637,955. These are, all sides, I think, agree, and the Court of Appeals acknowledge, ERISA plans. They are what ERISA actually refers to as an ERISA welfare plan. I don't think this case would be here if Christopher Allen Barnett had designated on the plans his mother, Dora Ernestine Luck Barnett, as the beneficiary. The respondent, the widow in this case, in her brief before you, has acknowledged that to the extent that she says, had that occurred, these policy proceeds would be what the law refers to as non-probate assets. They would pass outside the estate. In her pleading before the trial court, she acknowledged that ERISA benefits are, by definition, neither separate nor community property. Christopher Allen Barnett was not an academic. He typed his own will on his own computer, and in his will, he said, I leave everything to my mom. There were some other dispositions, but for purposes of this case, as it relates to the policy proceeds, he said, I leave them to my mother.
Well, once the proceeds were paid to the estate, does ERISA have any more concern about what happens to that money?
Yes. Yes, it does. The Supreme Court, in a case cited by the widow, held, and I'll quote, it's a case Boggs v. Boggs. It's what the Fort Worth Court of Appeals has called the seminal case, the seminal decision on community on ERISA benefits. That case, the court wrote, and I'll quote, it does not matter that respondents, if I may briefly give you an idea of what that case was about. In that case, Mrs. Boggs was married to Mr. Boggs for a number of years. Mr. Boggs was the employee, and he had the ERISA benefits. Mrs. Boggs executed a will in which she said, she lived in Louisiana, community property state. She said, I leave my half of the benefits yet to be received to my three sons, to our three sons, Mr. and Mrs. Boggs' three sons. Mrs. Boggs then died. At the time of her death, Mr. Boggs had not yet received his benefits. He was still employed. Thereafter, Mr. Boggs married another woman, married a new wife. Then Mr. Boggs died. The contest was between the sons, who believed they had inherited under their mother's will, and the new widow, the new spouse. The son said, we're entitled to those benefits because we're not challenging the plan. They waited until the benefits poured into the hands of the wife, and they then sued the wife for their share of those benefits. They said, this ERISA's not implicated because we're not attacking the plan. ERISA has no more interest once the proceeds are paid to this wife. It's a suit purely between us. The Supreme Court 1997 decision said, quote, it does not matter that respondents, who were the sons, have sought to enforce their rights only after the retirement benefits have been distributed, since their asserted rights are based on the theory that they had an interest in the undistributed pension plan benefits. Their state law claims are preempted. The truth of the matter is, and the long and short of it is, that ERISA benefits truly are not separate or community. They rise above that. They, you know, that under the preemption clause, the preemption.
But under Boggs is different than this case, because the Supreme Court in Boggs looked at the particular type of benefits that were an issue that were subject to a provision of ERISA that had an anti-alienation provision, which meant it put at issue the actual purported transfer of the interest in those benefits from the deceased wife to her sons, which occurred before the point in time that the employee died and purported to leave them to his second wife. So we really do have, in that instance, the whole basis of the claim was something that occurred at a point in time before the benefits were paid.
Well,
and we have the specific anti-alienation provision of ERISA at issue that was found to be the source of the conflict with the community property law.
Respectfully, Judge, I think that the Boggs case addressed both benefits that did have anti-alienation provisions and those that did not.
And to the extent the Boggs sons were suing, it was dependent on whether or not their mother's will had some effect on their father's benefits.
I'm sorry, maybe I missed what you said.
In Boggs, the son's claim against their father's second wife was dependent on how the court decided their mother's will affected the benefits under the plan.
I would agree.
In this case, there is no activity that this claim is being predicated on how whose rights are to what amount of those benefits. They've already been paid as they were directed to be paid, which is to the estate.
Correct.
And the interest in that amount of money is as between the husband and the ex-wife, and not as to where the benefits should have been paid. She's now arguing he has an estate, he's got money in that estate, and now we want to divide the estate according to community property.
Exactly, but you can't do that under ERISA, Judge, because the ERISA benefits are not community property. They are not properly characterized as community or separate. Boggs makes that representation. And the problem she has is, as you know, the cornerstone of community property rights is the inception of title doctrine. She's saying these benefits, which are neither separate nor community, are paid after my husband's death. And then when he's dead, when the marriage is dissolved by death, then she says they spring into life as community property. Well, by definition, when the marriage is dissolved by the death of a spouse, there can never become a community property claim to rights that are recognized and realized and received thereafter.
Well, let me ask you, suppose he hadn't left a will.
Had he died intestate?
Right. Then there'd be nothing you could do with the money, since you can't...
No.
Since the money is not affected by state law, which otherwise says how you have a distribution if you're intestate. It just kind of sits there. It seems to me that's your argument.
that since it's not community and it's not separate, then any effort to go to try and decide how those funds get distributed would be preempted by ERISA.
Well, no, I don't know that that's my argument. Obviously, if he died intestate, then and naming his estate as the beneficiary of the policy proceeds, then the plan administrator will properly pay those proceeds into the estate, and there being no disposition by will, then state probate intestacy laws would direct the disposition of the policy proceeds. I'm just saying that when it goes by will and he specifically directs, I want this to go to my mother, community property considerations should not just spring into being where they did not previously exist. I'm getting short on time. I'll skip over the separate...
When you characterize Boggs as saying, basically, if ERISA benefits are at issue, community property has nothing to do with anything. I mean, it's not even in the picture. And I take it that's the way you read Boggs.
That's the way I read Boggs.
Then if as an employee, I use some of my income to purchase insurance, supplemental life insurance, through my employer, that's subject to ERISA,
correct?
Because it's an insurance plan that's provided by my employer. But I'm using
community funds to purchase it.
But does that mean that after I die, that my husband would have no claim whatsoever towards anything to do with those insurance benefits, and I can do with them whatever I want because even though I've used community to purchase them?
Absolutely, and the cases are numerous on that point and are consistent. Your husband would have a claim for reimbursement for one half of the community funds used to purchase or to pay those premiums.
Well, but you just said though that once you get into ERISA, community property law has absolutely nothing to do with anything, and that would make it seem like you couldn't even make the claim for recovery of half the amount of money that I spent to purchase the insurance.
No, I don't think that that's the argument. I don't think that's my position.
Okay.
The case law on that, however it's shaped out, the case law on that is clear. The policy proceeds go according to the plan documents executed by the plan participant. The right of reimbursement, however, exists because those were community funds that would... It's the same as if my
the
wife...
Right, the right of reimbursement exists because under federal law it's recognized or because under state law it's recognized?
Because under state law it's recognized. But that doesn't affect the disposition of the policy proceeds, which are governed by federal law.
Well, but if under federal law the policy proceeds are distributed the way the employee has designated under the plan. So like in this case, the decedent designated his estate. And in fact, the plan then placed the proceeds to the estate.
Correct.
At that point in time, if as a result of the distribution of the estate and so on and so forth, there's not a fair allocation of the community as a result of that, are you saying that Texas law can have nothing to do within that particular instance stepping in terms of making sure that the spouse is fairly treated?
Yes, because that is an area preempted by ERISA, and that is not to say that the widow...
But the plan documents have already been fulfilled. The plan did exactly what it was supposed to do. It paid the proceeds of the insurance policy to the designated beneficiary. They're finished. They've written their check. They've gone home.
Right. And your question is what? I'm
sorry. So why does state law at that point in time step up to the plate in terms of deciding what happens during the course of the probate proceeding and in terms of what ends up happening if, in fact, someone has a claim under state law to the proceeds at that point in time?
Because ERISA says they don't have a claim. ERISA says they are not burdened by the restraints of community community property law. ERISA doesn't recognize that distinction. ERISA said, there's no question.
There are ERISA benefits from now for all time, basically,
right,
is what you're saying.
Right. There's no question.
There's not a point in time where, after they've been played out, the interest that Congress has said to be furthering by ERISA have been fulfilled.
Exactly.
And so there's not a point in time where that ever ends? If that makes sense? I'm just trying to conceptualize the reach of ERISA.
The preemptive reach of ERISA by case law is extremely broad. Extremely broad. ERISA paints with a very broad brush. But to answer, lest you be concerned that the surviving spouse is sort of left out without benefits, she has, as you referred to earlier, the anti-alienation protections that are allowed to her to qualify.
Not for life insurance.
And ERISA is specific in that regard. It's what the United States Supreme Court in Boggs referred to as a delicate balance between the rights of the participant and the rights of the non-participant spouse. It says the axis around which ERISA's protections revolve is the concepts of participant and beneficiary. A spouse is not a beneficiary under the non-alienation provisions of ERISA. And as I think everybody would agree, had Christopher Allen Barnett designated his mother as his beneficiary, we wouldn't be having this discussion. Why should that change? Because he says, a non-academic, I don't know a better way to say it, doing things the way he thinks is right, I'll name my estate as beneficiary.
Let me stop it right there.
All right.
Let's suppose the proceeds were paid to his mother.
Well, in effect, they were.
But there's a judgment lien against his mother, and someone finds out about it, and as the proceeds are paid and they're deposited in a bank account, somebody garnishes that bank account. Would you be arguing that because the proceeds were paid to the mother through a ERISA plan, those proceeds are exempt from execution under state law to satisfy some of the debt?
No, not once they're in the hands of the beneficiary.
Okay, now suppose we've got proceeds from the ERISA plan that's paid as it's supposed to be to this gentleman's estate. And this gentleman has a judgment lien pending against him, and they find out the estate now holds these funds. Could the judgment creditor then bring a collection action against the estate for those funds?
I think he could.
Now, why can't the wife bring a claim against those funds?
Based on community property, because the funds were not community property.
If her entitlement is as a result of the community property laws and not as a result of him gaining his funds and having them saved in the account, then ERISA says that doesn't apply.
I believe that's what
she
ERISA
can't
says.
Do that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Watson will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court. If I may, I would like to respond to the first question that was asked of Mr. Dana, which was that once life insurance proceeds are paid to the estate, does ERISA have anything further to do with the disposition of the proceeds? And the Fifth Circuit has directly given us an answer to that. In Nickel versus Estate of Estes, on pages 300 and 301, footnotes 4 and 6, it clearly says that ERISA does not preempt state law governing passage of the proceeds from Annie's estate to the beneficiaries of her will because the plan does not discuss how the proceeds should pass from a beneficiary's estate.
Do you agree with the petitioner's statement that if the mother had been designated as the beneficiary, we wouldn't be here?
Oh, absolutely not.
You would still be making the claim?
Indeed.
And why wouldn't that directly impact the designation of the beneficiary under the plan?
I think that it would not, because once life insurance proceeds are paid to the estate, and as the Nichols case said, for administration, indeed they would be subject to claims of creditors. The executor has the duty to characterize property in the estate.
I think you misunderstood his question. I think you may have misunderstood his question, because that's the same question I have. Let's assume that the deceased had specifically designated his mother as a beneficiary for the life insurance proceeds, that they did not pass through the estate. The proceeds would be, under the terms of his designation, paid directly to his mother. Now,
I'm sorry. You're right. I did not. Now, if I may address that, I have cited a number of cases in the brief where that has, where someone other than the spouse has been designated as beneficiary. Now, as Martin versus Moran said, a designation of a life insurance beneficiary is a gift by the insured. An insured may not give himself his wife's community property by designating his estate as the beneficiary. Now, there are instances in which designating another person besides the spouse as beneficiary is perfectly proper. There are times when...
What about ERISA? What impact does ERISA have? Let's assume the husband had said, I want my insurance proceeds to be paid to my mother, HLMP. And what impact, if any, does ERISA have on that?
ERISA would preempt state law if the state law tried to curtail, regulate, or affect the life insurance beneficiary designations.
So you wouldn't be here if that had been the case?
Oh, I would. If my mother had been beneficiary? Oh, yes, ma'am.
How could you challenge that under ERISA?
In order to avoid the wife's claim of constructive fraud of her rights, right? I would recognize that employee benefits are community property, as Taggart versus Taggart said. I would also recognize that ERISA affects community property law, where the anti-alienation provisions further the policy of the federal government to keep widows and orphans off of the welfare rolls when the wage earner dies. But once we get past those special provisions, which do not take away the wife's community property, it ensures the wife's half and gives her more for her family. But when it gets to the life insurance beneficiary designation, and ERISA is absolutely the same as Texas law, since there is no conflict, then there is no, preemption does not come into account. So, if the effect of making the mother the life insurance beneficiary is unfair to the wife, in that the wife is deprived of her one half of the community estate, then the wife has been defrauded, because the husband may not give away her property without her consent.
So the wife could sue the plan administrator and say, give me half the benefits.
No, that would never happen, because the plan administrator didn't do anything wrong.
He's got the money.
I'm sorry?
He's got the money.
You mean an intercedor suit, maybe? Yeah. I don't believe there would be any cause of action to assert at that point, because the plan, the beneficiary designated under the plan is the estate.
No, it's the mother.
I'm sorry. Well, there could be an interpleader action, perhaps. But even so, if that is not attacking the plan.
Is the point that you're trying to make that the claim does not arise basically on the part of the spouse or the wife until after the plan has paid the designated beneficiary? I mean, in terms of the constructive fraud claim that you're referring to. So, therefore, there's no claim to be made against the plan until such time as the proceeds have been distributed. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, Your Honor. That is what I'm trying to say.
Then does that mean that you disagree with Mr. Dana that Boggs completely dispenses with separate and with community property law vis-a-vis ERISA benefits at all points in time? Does Boggs do that?
It did not, in my opinion, Your Honor. There's a series of cases where the non-employee, non-participant spouse dies before the employee. And The ERISA being, in effect, a spendthrift trust, not subject to disposition by testamentary or any other kind of transfer by the predeceasing non-participating spouse. And that seems
does,
to address
does our benefit, ERISA benefits subject to being characterized as community or separate property? I mean, Mr. Dana says that Boggs did away with that. That you don't get, this is kind of a separate category. We now have three categories in Texas. We have separate property, ERISA property, and community property.
Your Honor, I believe the media, the academics, if we didn't have community property in this state anymore, depending on who you worked for and when, we would all not have to speculate about it. There are I believe there are a number of cases cited in the brief where the issue has been, does ERISA nullify community property
system? What's the answer to that?
Systematically, it does not nullify the community property system. It will preempt a law that attempts to regulate a claim because it is ERISA-regulated plans that are protected. The benefits, once they are paid, are subject to state law. Monahan versus Meyer, after the life insurance was paid to the employee's fiance, his children sued her for undue influence because the beneficiary designation was made 2 days before their father's death. ERISA's defense was asserted saying these were proceeds. The court said, no, those proceeds have been distributed, and state law claims will then lie. Same thing with Ames versus Ames, where the plan administrator terminated the plan, distributed the proceeds, except for some which he pledged to the bank, which was then foreclosed, and the employees entitled to those benefits then sued him and the bank, and that was a common law breach.
Ms. Watson, do I understand you to be saying that as long as you sit by and let the administrator pay the proceeds according to the plan, that's the end of ERISA? You can, once the proceeds have been paid according to the plan, then people can jump in and fight all they want to over this bundle of money that's sitting here.
That is my sincere belief based on Nichols versus the State of Estes, because that's what it says. It's a 1997 Fifth Circuit case, and it's the only one I found that spoke directly to.
And so your argument to Mr. Dana really is that it's not that ERISA creates a different category of property. It's just the people can't fight over it as long as it's still a part of the plan. But once it's been paid, then state law affects where ultimately that money resides.
That's right. That's exactly right. If I may just briefly respond to Mr. Dwyer, when the plaintiff filed suit, she filed against the mother who was the executrix. During discovery, found that the proceeds had all been dispersed to a number of different people, then joined enough people where she could follow the proceeds and get her property rights restored. Those people were all served with citations that asked for joint and several liability. They did answer that they had no affirmative defense, they did not raise the issue of proportional liability or contribution. They did not say, of course they would first say, I have no liability, but if I do, it is limited to so much, and have cross actions against the other defendant. It wasn't raised.
Except if it's a constructive trust you're trying to create, it can only be to the extent of funds they've received.
Well, I think that under Carnes, well, it's not the only avenue. I think that is the one most often found, because someone has received the funds or you would not be looking to them for reimbursement. But the plaintiff sued for the right to follow her funds into the hands of the transferees. These were transferees, and she asked for joint and several liability. Now, the rules of procedure say to them, you know, if you think that you're only liable proportionately rather than jointly and severally, raise that as an affirmative defense. If you don't ask for a contribution from your fellow defendants, you don't get it.
What's the legal theory for pleading joint and several under the facts of this case?
At the time the pleadings were filed, the discovery had not gone forward to the point that it did ultimately. But since they were joint tortfeasors, in effect, by being holding funds that they were not entitled to, then it was joint and several liability that was paid for.
Well, but aren't the facts of this case that the funds they received, each one of these respective defendants, were gifts to them?
I would.
As far as the one who paid them. I mean, they had no contractual right or otherwise, or were not part of the beneficiaries named in the policy or in the estate. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Because the proceeds of insurance were put into an estate checking account, and the executrix depleted the account by various disbursements and gifts, there was a breach of fiduciary duty on her part.
Mm-hmm. But not theirs.
A constructive trust is one imposed by law without proof of malice or fraudulent.
But only to the extent of the funds that you got, if you're going to impose a trust on, as Justice Enoch suggests.
Your Honor, if...
And then their procedural question is, well, how can the Court of Appeals, under all these facts, render a joint and several judgment?
When it was not raised by the pleadings? Is that
no, when it was not proven.
Oh, I mean the...
in summary judgment.
Well, there was summary judgment evidence offered. There was none.
But would you concede that you couldn't offer any evidence as to those defendants that they got any more money than they actually got, such as in Ms. Dias' case, $10,000?
Your Honor, I will concede that. I will say that for an issue to be litigated and appealed, if they want it in the case, there are procedures, there are pleadings to be followed and evidence to be offered.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand what you're saying, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
With regard to the issues that were determined by the partial summary judgment, I'm not entirely sure that I followed Mr. Dwyer's argument, but those issues are final. Even though it's an interlocutory summary judgment, unless the court sets the judgment aside. So, when we got to the trial of the case, the insurance issues were not submitted to the jury. They were already determined. And so, a directed verdict could have no effect on those issues because they were not issues to be submitted to the jury in the first place. But in Hendricks versus Thornton, 973 Southwestern 2nd, 348, the court said that even though the summary judgment was interlocutory, the issues were final, and so they were not before the court later. I have worry, too, about what happens to proceeds from ERISA life insurance that go into an estate in the event of intestacy, or do we expand the life insurance beneficiary designation from estate to read will, And if we expand it beyond that, do we say residuary beneficiary? Well, what if there is no residuary beneficiary? We keep interpreting, and adding to the language of the plan, which we're not to do. And so we must look to state probate law to characterize property and to the relationship of any heirs at law. I haven't heard any particular interest in some of my other issues, so I don't know whether to take the court's time with those. I will mention again that ERISA recognizes the community property aspect of employee benefits, and it did so when it provided for a qualified domestic relations order. So in the event of divorce, the wife, the husband, the spouse, the non-employed spouse could receive his or her interest in the plan. So since marriage is divorced, is dissolved by divorce or death, the spouse was protected at death by the anti-alienation provisions of the pension and retirement funds. But since ERISA didn't really regulate the life insurance aspect, then it is not taken out of the community property system. And once again, I do disagree that if the mother had been named beneficiary, that we would not be here, because that gift by the wife, by the husband, of proceeds belonging to the wife would have been unfair to her, because it left an unreasonably small amount of community property for her, divested her of her rights in the community.
Assume the divorce was effectuated before the death.
Yes.
What would the wife's claim be?
It would be whatever the qualified domestic relations order said.
And that would be based upon what?
That would be based on the family code, which is the court can divide the property according to what is just and right. And that varies. That's very subjective. But in the probate court, there is no provision for anything other than property that is characterized as separate from community, and it separately goes over to this community, it goes another.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
I don't know that you ever got an answer to your question. The question being, what would happen if Chris Barnett had named Dora Ernestine Love Barnett as his beneficiary? The answer is, it would have gone to Dora Ernestine Love Barnett.
Why?
Well,
without any claims then afterwards.
Exactly.
Why?
Because of the preemptive sweep of ERISA, and that.
Your view of Ms. Watson has told us that ERISA does not nullify community property law, but it preempts that law when there is a conflict, and says that community property law is still alive and well. What's your response to that? And that seems to be an important piece of how that question would be answered.
I would agree. This case turns on that question. That is the question that you will decide.
But under your view, there is no community property law anymore when it comes to ERISA benefits, and therefore that just answers the question.
That is correct, with regard to those that are not burdened by the anti-alienation provision.
Well, how does that fulfill the purpose of ERISA, though? If ERISA is designed to protect the employees and the beneficiaries, but not as against the world.
Or the spouse.
or the spouse,
right,
or creditors,
right,
or anyone else.
That's right.
It's to protect them as against what? The employers, the insurance companies, and the administrators. So how, giving this broad preemptive sweep that you want us to give that wipes out any community property interest in a life insurance policy if one exists, which is what I think your position is, how is the purpose of ERISA fulfilled? The purpose of ERISA is not designed to cut spouses out of the loop.
To some extent it is. To some extent, portions of ERISA specifically are intended to protect spouses. And other portions are intended to allow the participant to have 100% control of the disposition of his benefits. And you have to look at which is involved.
I understand. And her position is that's why he gets to designate whoever he wants to designate.
And then she grabs it once he's done it.
But after the proceeds, well, do you disagree that if the proceeds are then paid out to his estate, plan's finished. A creditor of the estate cannot come in and make a claim on it?
No, I think if he does it that way, I believe it is subject to attachment by a creditor.
Well, then why wouldn't it be subject to a constructive fraud claim by the spouse?
Because it's not community property.
Now that ultimately goes to the merits of it. Understand that you just...
Right.
But under your view, it sounds like no one can ever touch that money because it gets protected for all time. I'm just trying to understand how it fits. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time.
Well, I thought I was clear, maybe not. Let me just read this one paragraph from the Nickel case that Ms. Watson cites to you. It says, if designation on file controls, ERISA administrators and courts need look no further than plan documents to determine the beneficiary.
I think she agrees with you about that.
Well,
I heard her agree and say that she doesn't have any complaint at that point in time. That in fact, the plan and ERISA would require that beneficiary receive the proceeds. It's after the proceeds have been paid and are in the hands of the beneficiary that at that point in time, if there are other interests under state law, that would then come into interest and we'd be looking to state law for that resolution.
Well, let me just answer you this way.
Okay.
Can any cogent argument be framed to suggest that ERISA, for whatever reason, wants to protect the rights of the participant to designate as beneficiary, but if he makes the mistake of passing it through his estate, he has forfeited that right? I mean, I don't see the distinction. I see a legal technicality that allows the wife to in effect, thwart what ERISA tried to allow him to do.
The Ninth Circuit disagrees with you.
Which case is it?
I don't know that I have it out here. There's a recent Ninth Circuit case in which the panel determined that once the beneficiary had been paid, then under California community property law, the constructive fraud claim could be brought against...
Enard.
Is that pre or post box?
Post.
It's post box?
Yes. I believe it's post.
You just circulated by a letter recently.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
The name again, Judge?
What is it, Judge?
May I respond by letter to that?
Sure.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments in today's causes. These are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez.